Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Iranian authorities have barred all journalists for foreign media from reporting on activities in the streets, and some foreign reporters are leaving as their visas are not being extended. Meanwhile, a spokesperson for Iran's Guardian Council says the vote recount, called for by Iran's supreme leader, will be limited to voting sites where candidates claimed irregularities. And conservatives here in the U.S. are being critical of the Obama administration's muted response to the disputed election, but does the U.S. have a choice? Let's take a look at Iran through a diplomatic lens with Jonathan Marcus, the BBC's diplomatic correspondent in London. Jonathan, how are other countries approaching the trouble in Iran?
You could sum it up with one word: caution, by and large. I think most Western governments, certainly the European Union, followed very much the tone set by the Obama White House, obviously concerned about the violence, concerned that the Iranian people should, as far as their election allows it, be able to express their democratic choice, but obviously not, by and large, wanting to say anything that is going to inflame the situation. One notable exception, I have to say, has been the French President Nicolas Sarkozy. He has come out right and condemned what he says is electoral fraud in Iran, and he's actually gone on to say this afternoon that the violence of the Iranian reaction is proportionate to the scale of the fraud.
Does President Obama have a different road to walk here, given that he and his administration are trying to have some form of talks with Iran over its nuclear program?
Well, absolutely. I mean, look, the United States' relationship with Iran is markedly different. It remains to some the great Satan. So that's one element. The other, of course, is that the United States is the point man for the West in terms of future negotiations with Iran. The president, I think, has made it pretty clear that once things do calm down, the U.S. policy of engagement is going to be rolled out. I think, though, there will be many, and we're seeing many American commentators and diplomatic commentators around the world already saying that the way this election has unfolded is going to make that task of reaching out to Tehran that much more difficult.
Well, Michael Leadon, who's a conservative foreign affairs specialist at the American Enterprise Institute here in the States, says that he thinks the silence of the Obama administration is one of the most shameful things he's seen for years. But then he says, I'm sure they feel trapped. If they criticize the Iranians, they will feel they'll lessen their chances of negotiations in these talks you've been speaking of. But what do you make of the fact that the newly reelected president, Ahmadinejad, is in Russia today?
The fact that he's gone suggests that he feels fairly secure. And of course, he himself has made some of his rather typical rhetorical comments there, suggesting that the capitalist economy is declining and the age of empires, as he described it, is at an end. So no change rhetorically, at least from Mr. Ahmadinejad himself.
And how do you see this crisis exposing fissures within Iran, within the clerics, within the military?
Well, look, it is fascinating because I think the kind of stereotypical view of Iran has always been a rather sophisticated country with a modern middle class, ruled, if you like, by a clerical elite, which is clearly, many would have it, out of touch with the modern world. What we've seen in the unfolding of this crisis is something much more complicated, because for the first time, really, we've seen clear and open fissures within that elite itself. We know President Ahmadinejad is strongly supported by the army and the Revolutionary Guard elements and so on. So that's another key set of actors in the drama. So what we're seeing is, for the first time, is tensions and problems within the regime itself, plus obviously this extraordinary outpouring on the streets, some of which has clear political messages in terms of support for one candidate or another. Some of it, of course, might be much broader concern at the whole nature of the Iranian regime. But how these forces actually play out is clearly going to be what determines the outcome of this crisis.
One last question. You and others say Mousavi is perhaps not the ringing moderate that some of his supporters think he is. But what about the people who are expressing support for that kind of a movement for their country. We've had reporters in Iran say this genie can't be put back in the bottle.
Well, I don't think it can. Remember, we have people, you know, sending in Twitters and to the extent they can email and
right.
so on. We have a sense of what some people, at least in Iran, are thinking. But remember also that in the poorer, the rural parts of the country, there is also very, very strong support for President Ahmadinejad himself. I mean, at the moment, we still don't know. Was this election a total fraud? Or did perhaps Mr. Ahmadinejad actually win, but they actually gerrymandered it to an extent in a very crude way, which inflamed the passions of many voters? I mean, we still don't have an answer to that question.
Jonathan Marcus, BBC's diplomatic correspondent in London. Jonathan, thanks so much.
Pleasure. Thank you, Robin.
Well, we'd like to spend a few minutes today remembering a young woman who came through our studios on her way to trying to change the world. Tembi Ngubane was diagnosed with HIV when she was a teenager in South Africa, living in a Cape Town shantytown where people didn't talk about AIDS. Neither did Tembi at first. Then radio producer Joe Richmond gave her a tape recorder, told her her story was worth documenting. You may recall her audio diaries broadcast on NPR and then around the world. They began with Tembi talking to her virus.
Hi, this is Tembi. It's time for my prayer. Every morning when I wake up, I'll run off to my drawer, take out the mirror, and look at myself. I say, hello HIV, you trespasser. You are in my body. You have to obey the rules. You have to respect me. And if you don't hurt me, I won't hurt you. You mind your business, I'll mind mine. Then I'll give you your ticket when your time comes.
Tembi Ngubane was just 24 years old when she died last week of AIDS-related tuberculosis. It's hard to believe she was just 20 in April of 2006 when she and Joe Richmond visited our studios. Our conversation began with Tembi explaining why she decided to begin each day with that morning prayer to the virus that had invaded her body.
I was sick and tired of getting angry at other people for no reason and always lashing at other people and always shouting at other people. While the important thing that I was fighting with was my HIV. Yes. So I just thought that I need to tell the HIV. So I thought, okay, just because I don't know how it looks like and I don't know how it is, but I know that it is my blood, I felt better when I'm looking in the mirror. I feel like I could see it through my own skin. I could see inside me and I could see it. So I came up with this mirror so that I can talk to it, and by the time that I'm not getting sick, I think it is behaving.
It's behaving.
Yeah.
How did you get infected? Do you know?
Well, I was diagnosed HIV positive 4 years ago. I was not sick on any kind of way. I was not feeling any kind of illness. It's just that my boyfriend, who I was seeing in the past few years before then I was diagnosed, he became very sick, and then no one would talk about it. His family was hiding how he's ill and all the cause of his illness. People keep on telling me that and warning me that he was becoming very thin, losing hair, all that stuff. So I became very afraid that he had AIDS, and then he suddenly dies. And that was pushed me most to go for an HIV test.
And that pushed you to go for a test.
Yes.
You were told that you'd been HIV positive for a long time. But then you have a new boyfriend, Melikaya, and then you infected him.
Yeah, that was very difficult because I was not tested yet when I met him. So I got tested while I was with him.
Yeah, but it was too late for at
yes.
least. Let's hear a little more of that from your diary. Let's listen in.
Melikaya.
Yeah.
Do you ever wish that maybe you have never met me?
No. Just because the only thing is that I love you. You know that.
Yes. But I'm the one who's infected you.
I don't want to blame you. You didn't chase after AIDS. You didn't go on top of the mountain and said you want to have AIDS. You know? And I don't want you to blame yourself. Just be strong.
Okay. For me, what scares me most is that I think we are not going to die at the same time if we die.
I know that you think if you die first, I'm going to have another girlfriend.
No, I'm not thinking you must die first. No, I'm not thinking you must die first. Really, I'm thinking that if one of us dies, you, how would it be? At least if we were going to die at the same time.
That's Tembi and Gubane talking to her boyfriend, Melikaya. Both of them HIV infected. Both of them have AIDS. And now both speaking out, Tembi. You talked about how in your township nobody talked about the fact that your previous boyfriend had AIDS and then you didn't know you had it and there was this sort of, you know, and now here you are making these audio diaries. Why?
Well, I felt like it was my duty to speak out and also to warn other people, because I saw what it did to my old boyfriend by keeping quiet. I felt like it was best to talk about HIV and AIDS more openly.
And enter Joe Richmond, radio producer. You were in, I believe you were in South Africa doing your documentary on Nelson Mandela, which won you a DuPont Award.
Yeah, we were working, my wife and I were living in South Africa doing the series called Mandela in Audio History. Mm-hmm. And I had started to interview a bunch of teenagers, actually, in the township where Tembi lives in Khayelitsha, with the idea of maybe telling this story, through a diary approach, trying to tell it in sort of a personal way. But I wasn't actually sure that I myself even really wanted to spend a year of my life working on this topic. Mm-hmm. To tell you the truth, it wasn't really till I met Tembi that I kind of really realized that I wasn't going to be telling the story of AIDS. I was telling the story of Tembi, and that was for me the way to kind of feel a little bit closer to this story.
Well, it wasn't always easy for Tembi to make these recordings. At one point, months had passed, Tembi, since you last picked up the microphone. Let's listen.
The reason that I didn't record was that I didn't want to hear my sick voice. I didn't want people to see me like this and hear me like this. I couldn't even look in the mirror. The way that I looked, my face was sort of becoming bones, you see, and dark, and my eyes were kind of big, and I was shaking, I couldn't walk. All the things that were happening, I thought they would never happen to me. My mother showed up. When she came into the house, she kind of stared at me, because the last time she saw me, I was fine, and now I'm thin like this. Then she said, "Tana Montenu Njej," and that means, "My child, why are you like this?" I just looked into her eyes. She was very afraid. And I just looked at her and I said, "I don't think I'm going to live for long."
Well, she was right. Tembi Ngame speaking in 2006. She died last week at the age of 24, but not before touching so many lives and creating one, her own daughter. Tembi Ngame spread a message of AIDS awareness worldwide. After our program, she returned to South Africa, addressed Parliament, became a contestant on Imagine Africa, an AIDS reality television show that teaches about AIDS prevention, and was so concerned about high school girls, as we're going to hear. We're revisiting a conversation we had with Tembi and radio producer Joe Richmond, who helped her produce her radio diaries. We'll have more after a minute break, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. We're reprising our conversation with Radio Diaries producer Joe Richmond and Tembi Ngubane, the South African AIDS activist who died last week at the age of 24. With the tape recorder from Joe in hand, Tembi documented her life with AIDS. Her stories then ran on NPR. In her diaries, we heard how AIDS ravaged her body, but when she and Joe visited our studios, she looked healthy and beautiful, and I asked her what had happened.
The only thing that helped me is that my doctor recommended that I start on ARVs because
You start on?
Antiretroviral drugs. Mm-hmm. Because my CD4 count was very low. So I was very weak. So he suggested that I start on ARVs as soon as I get better from getting sick.
You know, it's funny, these antiviral drugs, we heard reports here in the U.S. that in South Africa, there was a lot of controversy over the drugs. A lot of people even thought that the drugs might be causing the illness, that there was some plot to make people sick. What was your thinking about? Were you ever fearful of taking the drugs or, you know?
Well, I was very afraid to take the drugs because the doctor told me before I got sick to take the drugs. I was fine by then, but I thought that I looked healthy. There's no need for me to take the drugs.
But you did take your antiretrovirals, or ARVs, as we hear in your diary. Let's listen.
Oh, hold on a minute.
Okay.
This is Tembi again. That was my cell phone alarm. It does that every day at 9 a.m. and at 9 p.m. When it rings, I take my ARVs. You must take them the rest of your life. Okay. I swallow them. That's it. I wish I didn't have to drink this.
Well, now, advancing your story, you and your boyfriend, both infected, very much in love, and you get pregnant. What did you think when you got pregnant, knowing that you had AIDS?
I was afraid that maybe if I could have a baby while I'm HIV positive, they are going to arrest me. I was afraid of the people's insults. Maybe they are going to say that I'm bringing up the baby that is going to die while I'm also going to die. And then I felt very happy when the doctor told me that there are some things that they can do to prevent the baby from getting infected, AZT and nevirapine.
Joe, just help us here for a second. Does AZT always block the virus from mother-to-baby transmission?
No, nothing always blocks it, but, you know, mother-to-child transmission is actually the one kind of bright spot in terms of AIDS research and treatment these days, because with no intervention at all, I think the rates are around 30% or 40% if the mother is breastfeeding. If the mother doesn't breastfeed, if you take some drugs like AZT and nevirapine during labor and right after birth, and also cesarean sections help, if you do all those things, it gets down to about 2%.
Tell me, do I understand your father didn't even know you had AIDS?
Yes, because I thought that if he had found out, he will lose a trust in me, and he won't want anything to do with me. And it's also, I thought it was going to cause the conflict between the family. Maybe he's going to blame my mother.
Did you ever tell him?
Yes, I did. The tape recorder helped me, actually. Doing this diary helped me to tell him, because as I continued to do the diary, I just fell in love with the diary.
The diary?
Yes, I felt like it's something that I was made to do. I just wanted everyone to know about it, but I had this obstacle standing in front of me, my father. That's when I decided that I have to tell him, and I'm going to tell him.
And you did?
Yes, I did.
Okay, my kid.
Okay, 3 years ago, I was discovered HIV positive. I have AIDS.
Oh, my.
I felt like I have disappointed you. I thought that it was going to break you into pieces. You see? How do you feel?
I feel bad, you see. But what can I do? I have to accept it. What can I do?
Tembi, actually, you recorded, that wasn't the only, you know, you recorded a couple times actually trying to tell him.
Well, I've been trying a lot of times, but I just could not tell him. I thought he was going to shout and say, get out now, I don't want to hear this. But he was shocked, and he was very hurt.
Hurt?
Yeah, he was hurt. I could see that he was very hurt.
Well, Tembi, that, you know, that raises the question. A lot of times when people get involved with a taping project, it does what it seems to have done for you. You know, it strengthens them. It, you know, telling your story, that's very empowering. But at the end of the day, you still have AIDS.
I do think about that, but I have accepted, because I know that it's not going to go away. So there's no point for me to sit down there and think about it and stress and cry. I must just continue living. I'm not scared of dying, but I'm scared of not being here. leaving my baby behind. I just want enough time to see her grow a little bigger.
We are old now.
I want to study further. I want to have a great job. There are a lot of things that I want to get done. I'm just going on with my life.
Tembi Engame did go on with her life. Producer Joe Richmer recalls in his Radio Diaries website statement after her death last week that Tembi thought HIV should be afraid of her, not the other way around. In 2007, she traveled to India to make a film about women with AIDS. She met children in Germany attending the Junior Summit who never met anyone with AIDS and spoke with a script and from the heart. Joe also writes of Tembi's visits to a rural school in South Africa. The girls wanted Tembi's autograph, but there was no paper. So she asked the students to hold out their arms and sign them one by one. About Tembi, Richmond said, more than 5,000 people die from AIDS every day. I never thought that Tembi would be one of them. She was the most alive person I've ever met. Tembi, we heard you, and we miss you. Tembi Engabame leaves her boyfriend and their 4-year-old daughter. For more on how you can help that child, go to our website. Back after the news, here and now. Twitter, the online messaging service where users can post a few words at a time, has been flooded with tweets about Iran. Seconds after yesterday's news report from the Associated Press warning of shots fired at a rally, we read Persian Kiwi's tweets about hearing shots in the streets of Tehran. But is the Iranian government clamping down on internet activity? Noam Cohen writes the link-by-link column for the New York Times. And Noam, we know that a Twitter user named DDOS Iran was calling for people to crash government websites in Iran by overloading them in protest of the election. He seems to have disappeared today, though Twitter says they didn't take him down. His call, by the way, was controversial.
I think, you know, why that was controversial, the idea of sort of having people send the equivalent, I guess, of spam or nonsense to sort of at government sites to try to knock them down is that it's such a blunt tool. And I think even when you're talking about shutting Twitter down, that as I talked to one expert, this professor at Harvard Law School, Jonathan Citrain, he pointed out why Twitter was so hard to shut down is that it really isn't just a person. It's a totally distributed model where a blogger can have it set up so that the blog post headline becomes a tweet. So it's like, are you going to shut down all the blogs too? In essence, you'd have to shut down the entire internet. So your question about the DDoS as well, it's such a blunt tool. People, I think, got very angry at that person who suggested it, because it's so non-directed. It's not directed correctly. And this writer had made the idea that basically, he calls it the cute cat theory of internet censorship, which is that you can't be so blunt in your censoring that you stop regular folks from like sharing photos of cute cats, because that's why people like the internet. Mm-hmm. And that if you can do it in a very directed way, like China's managed to do it, and people go on their lives and still look at cute cats, it's fine. But if you start saying the way we're going to deal with this, we're going to shut all messages or every website or all of Google or all of YouTube, you know, it becomes such a onerous thing that people realize that they're living in a very restrictive society.
Well, Twitter users are tweeting about how to get around potential government censorship, turning to what's called proxies. How do they work?
Right. So luckily I was able to even ask a friend about this who made a very good analogy. I'm in essence, he's saying that if CNN were blocked in Iran and he IMs me, right, instant messages me and says, what was CNN saying about what happened in Tehran? And I wrote him back and said, well, actually, this is what they wrote. I've become a proxy. It's a way of evading restrictions, either by having people create little mirror sites or create other ways of finding sites that have been sort of hidden.
Or relay a connection through another country so it doesn't have to look like it's coming from Tehran.
Exactly. So that's, again, why it becomes very hard to censor, especially if there's a committed group outside of the country that wants to help out.
Well, there's also fear being expressed by users that Twitter could be used by the government to send out misinformation. For instance, Ahmadinejad supporters could be masquerading as Mousavi supporters and telling people that there's violence when there's not, to keep people out of certain areas. So there seems to be some concern on Twitter that it's being co-opted.
The biggest, you know, problem with Twitter as a news source is the credibility question. So I guess the only, you know, antidote to that would be to take the view that, like, I know that this site, Mousavi 1388 was there, you know, a month ago when, you know, it wasn't clear who was going to win the election, and they were, like, saying, oh, by the way, can you help put stamps on envelopes? And, like, you go, okay, well, odds are if they were there a month ago before anyone thought there would be protests in Tehran today, I can trust what they're saying. I mean, that right. would, me would be logical. But if some Johnny come lately or Jane come lately were to appear, you might then go, that's weird.
Right.
You know, why would suddenly a Mousavi supporter crop up like that?
Meantime, some of the things we're reading, and thousands are added every few minutes. Someone's come on to say that Tehran University is being blocked by the Iranian police. Someone else came on today to say that several professors from Tehran University had quit. Someone writes here, student that reported the attack on the dorms on Sunday via Twitter didn't come back yesterday from yesterday's rally. So if you do an aggregate, you can assume that some of these are going to be relaying at least a feel of what's going on in Tehran.
Yeah, I think so. And again, that's where you have to try to, you know, determine if people are in Tehran. And again, you can try to do that by looking back in time on all the posts. And if you go back and see what were they writing before
right.
to try to verify,
yeah.
you know.
I'm not a fan of Twitter when it's just my telling someone that I'm going to get a bagel. But this seems more and more like a legitimate tool. Noam Cohen, he writes the Link by Link column for The New York Times. Noam, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Robin. Appreciate it.
Okay, we'll be back in 30 seconds to visit a stay-at-home geneticist here and now. We've all heard of garage bands, but what about a garage geneticist, or closet geneticist, if you will? 23-year-old Kay All, an MIT grad and former research associate at a biotech company, set up a homemade DNA lab in her Cambridge, Massachusetts apartment, complete with vintage thermal cycler to heat and cool DNA, to start combing through her own genetic code. We first heard about her work in the Boston Globe, where, look, there's a picture of her lab equipment in her shoe rack in her closet. And Kayal has brought some of DIY, or do-it-yourself, lab equipment to our studio as well. Welcome.
Hey.
I see all this stuff. I don't know what it is. But before we get to that, what started you on this path?
Several years ago, my father was diagnosed with a genetic disease called hemochromatosis. When my parents got the results, my mother gave me a call and said, I can't read this. I'm going to fax it to you. You read this. Tell me if he's going to die.
Once everyone figured out what he had and the fact that there was, it could be fatal if untreated, but there was a treatment for it, you decided to find out, do I have it?
Right. And so I thought about the testing process that my father had gone through and said, well, could I do this using basic lab equipment at home?
And you concluded you can. Let's just look at some of the equipment that you've brought in here. I see a blue-ish box and a darker blue box and an orange box with sort of jacks sticking out of it. What have we got?
Right. What we have here is basically a jello mold for DNA. You pour in agarose gel that's used to separate out DNA by size. The reason it has wires, DNA is negatively charged. It'll go towards a positive electrode. You plug this into a direct voltage source and apply voltage across this gel, and that will separate the DNA fragments out by size.
What you did with this is, if I understand this correctly, you swabbed the inside of your cheek, you
right.
know, just like they do on CSI, and you got a sample of your own DNA
right.
and then worked with that by what? Is that where the thermal cycler comes in?
Yes. And so the idea is I used something called allele-specific PCR, and PCR uses the same methods that your cell would use to copy DNA, copies it exponentially, and gone from something that's just a little bit of a cheek swab to something that you could see on an apparatus like this.
Right. And you knew what you had to look for to see if you had hemochromatosis, which, by the way, is when iron builds up in the body.
Right.
And what your dad does now is he gives blood regularly,
right.
and that sort of, you know, reduces the problem and the blood pressure problems and everything that's associated with it. And you knew what you had to look for genetically. You knew what the images looked for. Is it a damaged gene? What is it that you're looking for?
Right. It's a single base pair change. There are two very common single base pair changes.
Single base pair changes. What
yes.
does that mean?
You have a gene that's just a long stretch of DNA.
Mm-hmm.
Somewhere in there, at this specific location in the DNA, something's changed.
Ah.
A single letter. Instead of a T, you'll have a G.
Mm-hmm.
And you can read it using this allele-specific PCR.
Is it expensive to do this out of your shoe rack?
If you were starting from scratch, it would cost you $300, which is actually competitive with having it done professionally.
By a lab?
Yes.
Well, already I'm thinking, you know, we're not talking about a science project that I knew from high school. This is difficult stuff. You have background. You obviously have aptitude. Can anybody really do this?
I do have background, but certainly I wasn't born knowing this. Somebody had to teach me. One of the purposes of the DIY Bio website and mailing list is to get this information out there, to provide something like protocols or a recipe book that someone with less experience maybe wouldn't know enough to design it, but could read this protocol and understand it and do it.
Well, and there's a lot of it would be, again, what we've seen done. There are lights that make the DNA glow a certain way so that
right.
you can look at it. But is it possible that in the wrong hands, something could go terribly wrong? Can it blow up? Can it morph into something more dangerous?
With this experiment, the worst thing I could do is drop the thermocycler on my foot. The chemicals and reagents are totally non-toxic. It's all stuff that you would, you know, find in your kitchen or at worst in a pet store.
And what did you find about whether or not you carry these mutant genes?
Yes, it looks like I have it.
Well, how do you, you know, this is a question, now we're into another arena, which is finding out what might be in your future. How do you feel about knowing that?
Well, I would rather know than not. In this case, it's very treatable if you know you have it.
And you don't have it yet, right? You just
yes.
might have a predisposition to have it.
I have a predisposition for it. If I were going to show symptoms, it would not be it for another few decades.
What if you'd found out something else? I mean, you were looking to see if you had hemochromatosis, which is treatable. Did you ever worry you might find something else? In other words, is there ever a time you might think, maybe I shouldn't be doing this?
Well, there are certainly similar diseases, similar genetic changes that cause much worse problems. But even then, I would prefer to know. So even if it was something like, say, Huntington's disease, where you could run a test like this and say, you know, I'm sorry, you'll be dead by the time you're 50. I would be able to use that information to live a better version of my life. Maybe instead of putting 20% of my income towards retirement, I'd use that money to go on a cruise around the world, go skydiving, get a tattoo, and live a better version of my life. So I'd rather have the information.
Hmm. Do you ever worry about your genes, your DNA sort of floating around in a petri dish somewhere?
Well, I'm part of the Facebook generation, and I've always assumed that my drunken party pictures and my genome and all these other things will be on the internet for all eternity for people to see. But it's true that if someone were concerned about privacy or being discriminated against for insurance or employment, they could do this unofficially and have that knowledge without necessarily having to share it with the world.
That's true. You could do this and keep it private.
Right.
Yeah. Well, we know this is part of a whole movement, as you've said. We interviewed Hugh Reinhoff of the San Francisco area a few months ago. He set up a lab in his house to search through his 5-year-old daughter Beatrice's DNA. She was born with a rare genetic disorder, and he's one at the forefront now of finding out about it.
We were on a radio show together a few months back.
Ah, so you guys have been brought together by your stories.
Right.
So that's so interesting. So do-it-yourselfers like you might actually be able to help someone like him.
Yes, maybe. I mean, his is actually much more complicated. He doesn't know what he's looking for. His daughter is sick, and nobody knows why. You have idle hands of people interested in biology. He has this large collection of data that he's been combing through. Maybe having more eyes might make the bug spotting easier.
Huh. Well, that's Kay Ahl. She's a 23-year-old MIT grad who's created a do-it-yourself genetic lab to find out first about her own genes after her dad became sick and now looking outward to maybe help others. Kay, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
And let's just briefly note some of the news stories we're following. North Korea's state-run media is out with the government's version of why two American journalists were sentenced to 12 years of hard labor. The Korean Central News Agency says Laura Ling and Yuna Lee of Al Gore's Current TV illegally crossed a river from China to get into the North. And the report claims the women admitted in court that they planned to produce fake news stories to falsify Pyongyang's human rights record to, quote, isolate and stifle the socialist system. The women's families say the women had no intention of entering the North. Also, Health and Human Services Secretary Catherine Sebelius says school children would be first in line for swine flu vaccination in the fall, and they might be able to get those shots at school. The H1N1 flu has reached pandemic status just this week. So far, only 140 people worldwide have died from the disease, but health officials worry that a stronger strain could come back in the fall. We'll follow those stories for you. Meanwhile, we'll be back in a minute, here and now. Welcome back to Here and Now. This year's Pulitzer Prize for Fiction went to Elizabeth Stroud for her book Olive Kittredge. Well, we hate to say it, but we told you so. We first met the character Olive Kittredge last year, and she lingers. And we met her slowly through Elizabeth Stroud's collection of short stories. In the first story, Olive is the infrequently glimpsed, blunt-speaking wife of pharmacist Henry Kittredge. You wonder why the lovely Henry stays with her, but as he says, to leave Olive would be as unthinkable as sawing off my leg. Their son is named Chris.
Olive can understand why Chris has never bothered having many friends. He is like her that way, can't stand the blah, blah, blah. And they'd just as soon blah, blah, blah about you when your back is turned. Never trust folks, Olive's mother told her years ago after someone left a basket of cow flaps by their front door. Henry got irritated by that way of thinking, but Henry was pretty irritating himself with his steadfast way of remaining naive, as though life were just what a Sears catalog told you it was, everyone standing around smiling.
In the second story, we learn that Olive was once a teacher. She happens to show up as a former student contemplates suicide. In the third story, Olive makes a cameo appearance as a patron in the local bar, a wave of a hand, and she's gone. But through 13 tales, a complex picture of Olive emerges, like a Polaroid developing. Both the New York Times and the New Yorker gave Olive Kittredge rave reviews, and the Pulitzer Committee said that the collection packs a cumulative emotional wallop bound together by polished prose and by Olive, the title character, blunt, flawed, and fascinating. We spoke to author Elizabeth Stroud when the book was first published. How would you describe Olive? Who is she? A part of her is Maine, we should say. Her blunt speaking is...
Yes, I think that she is a product of where she comes from, which is many generations of that have produced Olive Kittredge on the coast of Maine. So she does have a bluntness. She does have a certain personality that almost aligns itself with the cragginess of the coastline itself.
The and the clipped speech.
Yeah.
And as the Times said, the clucking of communal disapproval. She has a little of that, sort of...
Oh, absolutely. She has a great deal of different disapprovals. Yes.
But what else would you say about her?
I think of Olive as being quite ferocious in her needs and unapologetic in going about getting what she needs in a way that makes her stand out as a rather powerful character and in many ways, I think, recognizable to ourselves, mm-hmm. although hopefully we're not quite as direct and forthright about what we need and how blind... One can be, she can be, we can be to the pain that we cause others.
And yet, she is, grossly overweight herself, but she weeps over a young girl who's got anorexia.
Absolutely. She's a strange combination, as I think many people are. She's very sensitive to the needs of others. However, those are people generally that are not as close to her.
Right.
The closer you get to Olive, the more her needs will consume you.
Or that she can't express to you appropriately what
exactly.
her needs are. She loves her son but drives him away. She
right.
puts her husband down at every opportunity, but thinking of him gone squeezes her heart so hard. She felt like a package of vacuum-packed coffee. Her heart has been stopped by events in her life.
Absolutely. The accumulation of losses has been something that has brought her great, great sorrow. And she does have heart. She has a fierce heart that can feel for people in all directions. But she's very intense, and her heartache is intense.
Yeah. Well, and we don't want to give away too much of the stories, because there's so many of them, and we get just a little bit from each one. But you know, having to do with a father who said to her years earlier, you know, sometimes I feel like ending it all. And she says, oh, Dad, sometimes we all feel that way. Well,
right. And then she has to live, and then she lives with that. And that's a, you know, unspeakably terrible thing.
Yeah, terrible
for
loss.
For anybody to have to go through. And it obviously has made its mark on her.
And is that, you know, a parent's suicide? Is that what sometimes shuts off her heart?
I think so. I think that it was a blow that was so large, and she, with her particular background and her time that she's living in, I mean, current time, she's really unable to understand the depth of that blow to herself and the effect that it's going to have throughout her life on others as well as herself.
Why did you introduce her to us this way? Why did you do it through these short stories? She's not even in some of them.
Right. It came to me unconsciously. The first story that I wrote of Olive was the first marriage of her son. And I think that I understood right away that she's such a forceful character that the reader is going to kind of need a break. And I saw it episodically more than in a traditionally layered kind of novel. And so it developed that way. It wasn't completely deliberate. It really was sort of unconscious that I would just write these different stories about Olive. And then I realized that it, for me anyway, I think it has the heft of a novel when you put it all together. And I'm very interested in point of view. So I love the chance to see her through the eyes of other people in the community, some who know her well, some who don't know her as well.
That's the magnificent part of this, because there's an interconnectedness that you start to realize that people in the background of a scene might be in the foreground.
Right.
The next day.
Right. That was very fun for me to do that, to give so-called minor characters the center stage every so often and to see, you know, what their life was like. And then to get that glimpse of Olive as opposed to having a full front view that we have in the other stories.
Was there someone, some prickly person who was sort of unlikable that helped draw you into this character, you know? There's got to be something there to that person that is unlikable.
Well, I come from many generations of Maine. I think on one side there's 8 generations, on the other side there's 10. That's a lot of ancestry if you add it up. And so even though I have lived outside the state of Maine for many, many years, this is a part of my background. These are characters or a compilation of different characters that I've known, certainly in my childhood, and just a kind of understanding, especially having lived away from Maine, I have a different looking back on it, or when I go up to visit, you know, I see that, you know, all regions have their own signatures. And so this character came from many experiences and many people that had passed my way.
People who had what, as you said, become like the landscape.
People who don't mince their words, people who are not particularly concerned with the niceties and will say what they perceive to be the truth.
Yeah. Well, that's Olive Kittredge.
Yes.
And in the final analysis, again, we're not going to give it away, but, you know, really tells the truth about herself.
Yes, she does. Too. If there's one thing you can say about Olive, she's pretty truthful. She has blind spots about herself, as we all do, but she's pretty truthful about.
Yeah, in the end.
In the end.
Do you want people to like Olive?
Many people will come up to me and whisper, I'm like Olive. Or they might come up and say, my wife is like Olive. Other people say, you know, she's a little too hard to take. But I have been very surprised that many, many people end up liking her. I think the most common thing I've heard is, I didn't like her at the beginning of the book. By the end of the book, I missed her dreadfully and I loved her. And I really want them to feel whatever they feel. The book belongs to them at this point.